This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
All right, here we go on a Monday. It's Cody and Gold. That's right, Dusty. He enjoys the start of the show. You can see him behind Drew, hyping him up. Video stream up and running. Facebook, Twitch, YouTube, Twitter, X. Make sure you subscribe. Makes it easy so you don't miss any of the shows here on 96.5 The Fan. Hope you guys had a terrific weekend. Opening day, just days away. Last check, it is going to be gorgeous for us out of Kauffman Stadium.
Last I saw, partly cloudy and 77 degrees.
Beautiful.
That sounds fine. Do you think it'll be windy like always?
It doesn't matter if it's that warm. I don't care. We're good. I'll take it based off past opening days.
Dustin
and
I sat next to each other when it snowed during an opening day not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I will take 78 and partly sunny. That sounds fine to me.
Yeah, no, I'm excited, man. And we'll get to some Royals news here in about 10 minutes or so. Unfortunately, on the injury front, did not want to be talking about that just days away from spring training, but not from the start of the season, but the last spring training game. You guys saw the video and the news around Vinny Pasquantino. Vern was on with Fesco and Dusty today. You'll hear what he said, maybe what the plan could be if, in fact, Vinny's going to have to miss some time. So we'll get to that in just a bit. But let's start with the tournament. Tournament Sweet 16, we're now down to 16 teams, and after the field of 68 was eliminated, a majority of it over the last weekend or so. And a lot of discussion is around how competitive the games have been. Did we have the drama that we would have typically? In the first 2 days, the answer, of course, was no. You know, you didn't have ones or twos or threes or four seeds go down in the first round. We did have a two seed St. John's go down on Saturday in the round of 32, and they're lost to Arkansas. We can get to Cal and Arkansas in a second if we want. Is this just a down year? Like, hey, let's not overreact. It's the first time since 2017, so it happened then as well. Or is this a sign that NIL has really impacted mid-majors, where if you were a junior on a mid-major that went on a run the year before or was quality, chances are you transferred. The Clayton kid who's a stud at Florida right now was at Iona a year ago. Would Iona have been in the NCAA tournament this year? I have no idea, right? If Clayton was still on their team, my guess is probably. But you look at some of the 12s, 13, 14, 15 seeds this year, were they the same quality even as we have seen in the past? Or is it just, hey, it was one of those years, matchups, maybe as we talked about Troy last week against Kentucky, not a great three-point shooting team, and so usually for those upsets, you need someone to be able to pull off an upset with a bunch of threes. Do you guys think this is kind of the future of the tournament, or this is a blip on the radar?
Okay, so it'd be easy to just say, because of the sample size, blip. But I'll say over the last 2 years, it's been trending this way. There were more double-digit seeds last year, but the rate in which favorites are winning in the NCAA tournament is increasing. And those players aren't staying. I fully think that this is a, unfortunately, permanent problem. That we might have robbed the NCAA tournament because we wanted conference realignment and because the obvious thing, which I do think, players should have a choice and not just being forced to stay at a school. My hope was is that, like, in this NIL era, and I know that they weren't going to be able to compete at the biggest level, but, my hope was, hey, you're a kid at a small school who's having success, that they would do whatever just to at least keep you, right? Like, we'll find a way. We'll find donors. And what it's turning out is, like, the dollars are so big at some of these other programs that they straight up cannot compete. And as a result of that, I think we are going to get this more and more and more every year. And it kind of stinks. Like, the first two rounds were just, like, no drama. They obviously had a couple of other better moments over the last couple of days, right? Like, it was a really good game last night. Or the
yesterday I thought was really good.
Yeah, it was honestly pretty good, right, overall. And so, like, yeah, there were some moments there where, but that's just like a numbers game. If I play 100 basketball games in a two-week time period, a couple of them are going to be tight.
Right, but I do think
the overall quality is down, and the upsets are down.
Yeah, no doubt they're down. I think the cause is NIL. But I'll say this: part of the matchups, and we like the tournament because of Thursday and Friday and the upsets. But the payoff, I think we are starting to see of that. And I know the casual fan, maybe that's the problem. It's not going to be for them, but it's leading to better matchups. I don't know if we'll talk Sweet 16 at 11 o'clock today. Some of the matchups next week are great because we didn't have the upsets. But yes, Thursday and Friday is about the drama and the game-winning shots. And is this team going to get upset? And we did not have that.
I guess that's what I like more about the tournament.
I think you're
it's probably
in the
kind
majority
of dependent.
Of
like the first 2 days are the most interested I am in the NCAA tournament during the entire run. It doesn't mean I don't watch the Sweet 16 or watch Elite Eight games or watch some of that stuff. But the things I'm most interested in, Gold, are those first 2 days when McNeese gets the upset or here comes the 13 or, and God, it was just lacking like a crazy amount of that. Arkansas, led by John Calipari, is the single biggest upset of the Sweet 16 and of the NCAA tournament. And like, if I put it in that perspective, that doesn't exactly seem like some small school hero coming to the rise, does it, right? Like one of the highest paid coaches in all of NCAA basketball in a Power Four conference in the conference with seven teams in the Sweet 16 in the SEC. Like, it felt like it lacked that normal buzz. And I'm not saying it's like, you're right. Maybe moving forward, I can appreciate this part and the Sweet 16 will just be awesome. And the Elite Eight will be awesome. And maybe that'll change my opinion on the way this setup is.
It looks like it's trending towards this is the norm, but let's see what we're saying this time next year is all I'm saying about it. Because I remember a year ago we were giving Carrington a hard time, I think, because he was saying that there are no more upsets, or not because there's no teams winning, but just that like everybody's so close. And then now we're acting like that upsets don't happen because NIL has ruined it. Right. A year ago was like we shouldn't be a year ago. Literally, the conversation was that there's upsets happen so often. Uh-huh. We shouldn't even think they're upsets anymore. And then now we're sitting here a year later saying, where are all the upsets? None of these double-digit teams are winning. So it's a reminder that let's pump the brakes a little bit on
it. You know, the craziest thing about this last year in 2024, five double-digit mid-major schools made it to the round of 32. Two made it to the Sweet 16. Let me get back to that in a second. Uh-huh. This year, four double-digit mid-major schools made it to the round of 32. None make it to the Sweet 16. However, those two teams that made it last year was 2023's national finalist and also Gonzaga, who made it to, I believe, seven or eight straight Sweet 16s. So this year is really not too far off at all whatsoever from last year. And let's say Colorado State hits let's say Maryland, Queen misses the jumper, and Colorado State wins. You could argue that Colorado State is a better story this year than anything that happened last year, even though there were more mid-major teams that make it. I think this is a lot of recency bias. If you look at McNeese State, I did some numbers last night. I spent an hour and a half doing this just for this conversation.
You and Aura over there, the student manager.
I was going nuts with Aura over this. McNeese, seven portal additions, nine of them they have 11 portal additions, seven from this year. Nine played in the tournament. Their entire starting five started. Four of them are from Power Five schools. There's five power conferences in college basketball with the Big East. Drake, none from Power Five schools, but there's D2 kids. They win a game over a school in Missouri that had a Duke transfer, one of the best players in the portal, there last year. So I think this idea that the portal and NIL is ruining college basketball isn't it isn't true because the portal
because one team won one game.
The portal has always been used for mid-major schools. That's the way it's always worked. Name, image, and likeness is just adding to it, but the portal has always been used regardless of whether it's name, image, likeness or not. If you were a good kid at a poor school, you would go to a good school. You might have to sit out a year, but that happened quite often. The smaller schools have always had to fight and claw and find ways to win and find ways to get new players in. A lot of JC talent, New Mexico, a lot of Power 4, Power 5 schools go to New Mexico or Colorado State. They end up winning these games. So the idea that the portal and these schools are getting, you know, sniped in the portal, it might be true in terms of winning, but like Danny Wolf, transferred from Yale, went to Michigan.
But you're only
Yale
describing...
Yale made the tournament this year and was very much competitive in their game against A&M. So I don't think it's not one single solitary thing that's killing it. It's more of blame the committee as well for putting the matchups the way that they are. I don't think this is a portal is killing college basketball thing as much as people want to say that it is.
But you're only describing one way. Like the issue with like that line of thinking, in my opinion, is that, yeah, players have always like, I flamed out at Michigan. I transferred to Yale. I became a really good player there, right? The big Power 4 kids who don't work out, aren't getting the minutes, and go to a smaller school. But those small schools used to keep their stars, and now they're gone. Like, those guys didn't used to leave their school. Steph Curry stayed at Davidson. He would have never made it.
No, he would have been
He'd been playing at Kansas or Duke or North Carolina long before their team ever did. And, like, McNeese State winning one game doesn't mean, like, it worked. It means you can make your team good fast.
We wouldn't know that, though, because Steph went pro the year after he took Davidson. So, we never know, because you can go pro now. So if you have a great year, Jimmer Fredette went to BYU when they were a mid-major school, was outstanding, and went pro. He could have stayed in college and gone to Duke, probably, but he left. So I don't know if that's a... Just based on the way that college basketball works and how things go in terms of the portal, and I didn't even get to Memphis, who also has 7 portal additions, and they were a mid-major who was a 5, and they win a game. I think it's a hard argument to make.
Time is going to tell on this, right? We're going to get a bit of more of a sample size. I think NIL has definitely impacted it. Do I think it means we're just never going to see upsets in the Thursday or Friday? No, I don't think it's that extreme, but it clearly has had some effect. I'll push back on like the committee screwed it up kind of thing. There's an argument that like if the fact that it's been somewhat chalky, the committee actually did its job. Like the committee's job is not to set up upsets.
I'm just saying I know, but I'm saying people want that. So if you wanted upsets, Colorado State shouldn't have played another mid-major school in Memphis in the first round. It should have been a little bit different. I think that's they should have included Boise State in there instead of putting North Carolina in there.
That's really hard. There's a
number of reasons that you can get mad at the committee if you wanted more upsets. But I think to your point, Colt, I think you're right. The committee found the teams and seeded them the way that they wanted things to go. Like, I think the college basketball games, while there weren't any really close games or anything like that, except for a few, it wasn't terribly bad basketball, no more different than it was last year when everybody was going nuts over DJ Burns and going nuts over Grand Canyon and whoever else was in it.
I think
Oakland.
The part that I do think is unique to this year, while there is an impact from NIL, is for whatever reason, the 12 to 16 teams, and I'm not going to take credit for this stat. Someone did some research. CB Central, Kevin Sweeney did this, but the 10, 12 to 16 seeds... played Friday, right? Only one shot over 30% from three, and that was Colorado State. They won their game. In all, there were 20 games played by 12 to 16 seeds. Only 4 of them did the team shoot better than 30%. Many of them were right in their games, despite that Robert Morris, you know, would have beat Bama, right, if they shoot 38% from three. The point being is it was a weird year where normally for those upsets, we talk about Jack Golke at Oakland. Like, he can't miss. Like, you know, you're going to shoot 50% from three. Well, that's how an upset happens.
That's the way it always has been.
Always been that way. For whatever reason, the 12 to 16 seeds, that wasn't their makeup or they just didn't hit their shots. Let's see what happens next year. Now, if it's another year where it doesn't happen, I think then we have to really say it's NIL. But I don't want to overreact because, again, 12 months ago we said, oh, we shouldn't be surprised by any upsets anymore. It's all level playing field now, and now we're like, it's not level, and it's all NIL's fault.
It's easy to say one thing and then switch to another a year later because of how things roll.
All right, let's talk some Royals baseball. Not the news we were hoping to talk about today.
No, sadly, in the last spring training game, of course, Vinny Pasquantino came up a little bit lame, holding on to his hamstring. He has a hamstring injury, according to multiple reports, including that of Annie Rodgers. So really the question is, what do they do about it? How long do we think this injury lasts? And what does this say about Vinny's overall health again this year? Look, he's made it abundantly clear on this show, on social, and a lot of other things. He hears the noise as it relates to his availability and how he has been hurt in every year. Yeah. He's been a big league player. Now, it used to be a shoulder problem. Then they got that surgically repaired. It didn't seem like it was that problem anymore. Then, freak injury last year, unfortunately, and he gets run into by a player on a bad throw by Urseg. And then he misses some time towards the end. Fought back really hard, I always want to point out, like to get even back in that season at all, which is crazy. Now a hamstring injury. Look, if it's three straight years, injury prone is what people are going to call you. Yeah. It just is. For the same reason, no one should ever argue with me if I say Hollywood Brown is injury prone. Like, sometimes things just find you. And look, I'm hoping that this one's pretty minor. I kind of think he's going to miss a little bit of time. We'll see. I think they're waiting on maybe some results to be sure. I kind of think he's going to miss a little bit of time on that end. But this is devastating news. He's their third most important hitter behind Bobby Witt Jr. and probably now Jonathan India. Maybe second most important hitter, even ahead of Jonathan India, even though he's not hitting leadoff. And yeah, I'm worried he's going to miss time again this year. And does it linger? And all the other stuff that kind of come with these problems.
Yeah, it sucks. No doubt it sucks, but it is fair to unfortunately use the phrase injury prone. As hard as that is to say, that's what is out there now, and it's understandable. Now, the hope is, it's early in the season. The season hasn't even started yet. There's no reason to push this hamstring.
No, I take my time with it, yeah.
There's no reason to force it. So go ahead and probably put him on IL for a couple. Hopefully it's a couple weeks, depending on the grade strain. It could be a couple weeks. You hope it's not more severe where we're talking about a month or two.
I don't think it is.
Hopefully it's short term. Get him on the 10-day IL, and hopefully by the end of the month or middle of the month, talking about April, of course, that he's back with the club. But they're obviously going to be very cautious with this. It sucks. Final freaking spring training game of the season, too.
Yeah, and it's just like, I feel bad for the person. We love Vinny on the show, and like, he's done everything he can to try to stay healthy. And of course, injuries like this occur in baseball and in sports in general. So like, it stinks again. But like in this case, take your time.
Yeah,
because
so what,
I won't feel this way if Vinny plays. I won't think injury prone if Vinny misses 10 games and then plays the other 150 or 145. You should be like, hey, you know what? Most players, I anticipate missing 2 weeks in the season. So if you land into that range, we're having a very different conversation. And if it happened at the beginning versus the middle, whatever.
Right.
But it's just about like limiting the amount of time he spends on the IL. If he spends time on the IL.
If he ends up on the IL, where do they go from here in the short term? Vern was on with Fesco and Dusty earlier today. And of course, Dusty asked about Cags, but what could the plan be?
Even if it is something that lands him on the IL to open the season, no, I don't think Jack Caglione, I don't think that we're breaking glass because of emergency on opening day. I don't think that's the most advantageous position to put Caglione in.
It's not going to be Cags.
It shouldn't be Cags. For the same reason I didn't want them to call him up a week ago or 2 weeks ago.
This is a short-term stint, if that's what it ends up being for Vinny, and it's so early on in the season, they're just going to go with the veteran option. You know, maybe they move an in-house option to first, but as far as like an actual player that gets more playing
Canna,
time.
Or who they just signed, played some first. We can talk about him in a minute.
Yeah, it could be him. They traded for him for cash considerations or whatever, or a player to be named later, 36-year-old. If you wanted to go really far down, someone that the organization was willing to put on waivers, he didn't get claimed or whatever, but Nick Prado. I mean, there's other options before they would get to Cags. They're not going to change their plan for him because of what is hopefully a short-term hamstring injury for Vinny. Let Cags do his thing in AA at Arkansas, get some reps in right field, get more comfortable against the curveball, all of that, and let's just see where we go from here. But it's a bummer that we're talking about it just days away from opening day, that Vinny has a hamstring injury. We'll find out probably by the end of the show. We'll see.
So, yeah.
The severity, at least get some clarity on what their plan is for him moving forward. And on Thursday, of course, we'll be out at Kauffman Stadium for opening day. We're expected to have multiple guests stopping by, including the general manager of the Kansas City Royals.
I will say my plan would be pretty simple. I would just play Salvi at first and put Freddie behind the dish. If we're talking like
that. Yep.
5 to 10 games, it's the easiest solution in the world. One, the organization loves Freddie Fermin, would be interested in seeing his bat in the lineup. I definitely, and I mean, this is funny timing now, last week on this show told you the thing people get messed up in baseball sometimes because it's an exposure sport and it's hard to understand is a guy can look like a really good 100-game baseball player, but if you try to make him a 162-game baseball player, it doesn't look the same. I fear that that would probably be the case with Freddie Fermin, is that if you extended him to be a 160-game baseball player, some of the things he does well would get exposed from a hitting perspective. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a couple of weeks where he plays more. And then, yeah, okay, Canna probably gets an extra start, or one of the extra infielders in Massey probably gets an extra start. But I don't even think they have to go outside of the regular big league roster, honestly, to cover it, just as long as it is a short-term injury for Vinny. The only way that it becomes Jack Caglione is if it's like later in the year and a serious one, right? Not 2 weeks, not 10 days, not 5 days. The roster is built and have enough people who can play first, built in a way that you can cover this injury for a short period of time. I would just do Fermin more. Maybe that's a bad way to look at it. I'd just probably play him more behind the dish and let Salvi catch. I get Salvi to rest his legs at the beginning of the season. Cool. I get to see a little more extended coverage of Freddie Fermin. That seems
fine.
You
know how this goes too, convincing Salvi, you know, a player of his stature too, that, hey, you're not going to be behind the dish out of the gate. I think that's part of it.
Like one a week or whatever. You know,
I don't think
works.
It'll be a full thing, but they've got obviously a couple days here to maneuver some things if need be to make it happen. But we'll let you guys know if there's any update on Vinny Pasquantino's hamstring injury during the show today. And I know that it's something that a lot of Royals fans are keeping an eye on after seeing the video. I think it was Harold Kuntz that put out the video yesterday where you could see very clearly him pull up there as he was running to first base and won his final. Ended up being his final at bat. Would have been his final at bat anyway. I believe he was scheduled to go out of the game at that point anyways. That's what also sucks. It literally was his final at bat, or would have been his final at bat of spring training anyway. It's my understanding.
That's just bad timing. I mean, I just feel bad for Vinny. Maybe it's something minor, but like, I don't want him to beat himself up over it or anything else in between. Again, keep it short term and then none of that has to chase you.
All right, let's talk a little college basketball coaching. A couple news and notes on that. One, within the last 5 minutes or so, Matt Norlander reporting that Colorado State's head coach, who we just talked about them, Nico Medved, is taking the Minnesota job. He's okay. Expected to be their next head coach, according to Matt Norlander. Then multiple reports this morning have noted that Ben McCollum is going to become the next head coach at Iowa. Drake's great
so
story.
He's just going from
great
Iowa
year.
City to Iowa ties. City, huh?
Iowa type from Des Moines to Iowa City, yeah. And we've talked at great length about 11 months ago, roughly ish. This guy was a D2 coach at Northwest Missouri State, and now he's
a power
four head coach. And I was texting with some Drake alums, and I've told you my brother-in-law went to Drake, and even though they knew this was coming, they're obviously still like, wait, we've got to start this whole thing over
again. Iowa?
That's part of it.
Specifically, Iowa. That's part of it. That kind of stings a little bit more, doesn't it?
From people I talked to, it was at least like, hey, if he would have gone to Indiana, would have understood it a bit more. Like, it's Indiana, or it's, you know, another job. But Iowa, I think, makes it sting more. And in their mind, it's like, hey, we got to reset again. We just reset after their head coach left for West Virginia, who's now at Indiana. And then Nico Medved left before that. And he was only at Drake for a year before he took the Colorado State job. So I think it's just this feeling that's revolving door. But that also is life of being a mid-major, right? Like,
yeah,
if you're Drake,
find your coach more often.
Would you rather have had an epic 1 year that you just had? You won 30 games, won an NCAA tournament game, or had a coach that stuck around for 5 years, but you were irrelevant? I mean, I'll take the historically
be able to
great.
Another good coach to come
tough,
your way,
right? It's tough.
It's going to be hard to find the next Ben McCollum.
But
yeah.
I'll say this, Drake. If you look at the conference they're in, the Missouri Valley nowadays, they're not much different than any other school in that conference, right? The struggles that they all are very. Nobody's saying they have a huge NIL budget. Nobody does in the Valley. Come on, now we're talking about Evansville and Bradley's of the world and Illinois State's of the world. So
if they have any NIL sucks. Budget, it's a good budget.
It sucks for Drake fans, the high of the season, and then immediately losing your head coach. What do you think about him taking Iowa though? And like, I do think there is some
kind
truth.
Of a perfect fit. We talk fit, right? Already knows the recruiting base, already working in Iowa, already recruits the Midwest and knows the talent, found some, like, and I'm assuming Sturts is just going to, I'm assuming he's going to take one to two kids again with him up.
Sturts is, of course, going to Iowa.
I mean, Sturts
Come
is immediately yeah. going to Iowa. So it just feels like he's doing it kind of in that similar way. At this point, the only thing that seems to be holding McCollum back is, can you get him the talent? Because I don't know how we can question his ability to coach at this point. He won four national championships at D2 level. He immediately, upon entering Division I, went 30-4 and won a game against a Power 4 opponent. And now he's getting out. Like, it's hard to imagine he can't coach. So, like,
oh, sure. I think Iowa's a tough job, though. I do think it is a tough job. Big Ten, if you compare Iowa resource wise to other Big Ten programs,
you're behind.
You've got some work to do. But he's, in fairness, he's used to having limited resources. Now, he's never competed at the Big Ten level throughout an entire conference slate. That'll be the challenge. But if he has success there, he will have an opportunity to even move up from there. You know, I think it's a great hire for Iowa, though, if we're just talking about for that program, you know, and how people view McCollum from a basketball mind. Time will tell, like all things with this kind of stuff. But I actually think it's a really good hire for them. And then, you know, the way that the college basketball world works, you know, people were upset, like one and done kind of stuff. The same way we talk about the transfer portal. You know, yeah. I am never going to fault this. Now we're talking about a coach, but certainly for the player. But in the coach, the guy was a D2 coach 11 months ago.
He was probably making like 150 grand.
I'm not going to fault somebody that for the betterment of their family is going to take an opportunity after 1 year. No disrespect to Drake, but you're talking about being at a Missouri Valley school. Now I can go to a Power 4 and I don't know what his salary is. Let's call it $2.5 million. I could be way off, but I think it's at least that. Yeah. I mean, come on. You know what I mean? Like, come on. The guy was D2, did his time there more than enough. And now he's going to be at a Power 5 school, making really good money.
This is also why I think, as much as people hate it, I 100% think that you have to let players transfer unlimited. Because if Ben McCollum can go from school to school to school year after year after year, then you have to give him the ability.
I hear you. The only question, we don't have the solution to that. I'm with you, but what can you, so coaches have buyouts, right? Like if he leaves Iowa in a couple of years, whoever hires him has to pay him. Let's just say the buyout's $10 million. I have no idea, right? Let's say it's $10 million buyout or something.
Yeah.
Just like Jerome Tang's buyout was $20 million if they would have got rid of him this year. Okay. So that is a clause that's in there. So what can we come up with that's fair? I'm with you. Players should be able to transfer if they want. No problem. But there's not a, is there a buyout in the future where a school can get an increase? Let's say a player is at Iona, gets an opportunity to transfer to Kansas in this hypothetical. And that player, it's just known in his contract, air quotes, his buyout is $100,000. Then Iona gets an extra $100,000 to use for their athletic budget or
That'd be fine with me.
I don't know what the exact terms, someone much smarter than me can come up with it, but I'm with you. If coaches can go whenever they want, they can, but there is a buyout that sometimes prevents them from getting a job. So the same thing should, to me, exist for players. Let them transfer. They get a better opportunity, but can there be almost like a buyout with the players in IL where the school, the small school in particular I'm talking about, to protect them, that loses the player, they get an NIL budget essentially out of it, a boost to their NIL budget.
The real question is, does college sports, now that it is officially a professional sports league, and it pretty much always was, but now because of NIL and everything else, it's a pro league, okay? It's the minors, essentially, for a lot of these, but it's a professional league. Is if they're going to work out the finances on this stuff, like you're talking about, and the way that this works is, are you going to care about competitive balance? Because what you're describing helps competitive balance. If Sturts gets plugged from Drake and you got to pay us $200,000, but it goes directly to the NIL fund, well, great. Now I got $200,000 to convince kids to go to Drake. Like that does create a competitive balance, which I like.
We'll talk more about this throughout the show today. Up next, though, I want to get into the NFL and the gap that may or may not have closed between the Chiefs and everybody else in the AFC, according to one publication. That's coming up next here on Cody and Gold.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW, because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour, the boots that turn grocery aisles into runways, and all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Take me out to the ball game.
What are you doing?
Did you know DirecTV has the most MLB games?
So you're singing?
Yeah, they put your favorite teams front and center right when you turn it on. Buy me some cold cuts and flapper jacks.
Those aren't even the words. I'm allergic to peanuts.
Stream DirecTV, home of the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks. RSNs available with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package.
Survivor 48 is here, and alongside it, we're bringing you a brand new season of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. If you're a Survivor superfan, you won't want to miss this deep dive into every episode where we break down how we designed the game, the biggest moves, your burning questions. It's the only podcast that gives you inside access to Survivor that nobody else can. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast with me, Jeff Probst, every Wednesday after the show, wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't forget, Basketball Madness is still going on here in Kansas City for the NAIA Men's College Basketball Championship, March 20th through the 25th, I believe. Tomorrow night is the championship game at Municipal Auditorium. 16 teams, 15 games, one national champion. You can bring the family still for the championship game for nonstop action, affordable tickets. Get yours today at NAIAHoops.com. Unfortunately, I did see our friends over at Baker got eliminated in the round of 16 late last week. A tough loss there to Oklahoma Wesleyan, but a great year for our friends over at Baker University. I do want to talk a little NFL before we get back into the Royals, who made some other moves over the weekend as they were starting to get the roster crunch time and opening day right around the corner. Post free agency, I think it's fair to say now, yes, free agents still exist, but we're post free agency. You know what I mean? Now these are just kind of like your off season signings, really, is where we're at.
These
it's
are
a different
like
category.
Low-tier. Drew and I were actually talking about Cincinnati's. Like, I was like, hey, I'm just curious, what do you like about what they did? And he mentioned like a guard. I was like, and then he's like, well, they're waiting on this other guard to see if he wants to retire. I'm like, okay, I see what level of free agency we're at, just generally speaking.
Yeah.
Waiting to find out if a player is going to retire. Is that your point? the depths, the doldrums.
Yeah, and so you think about how everybody that's chasing the Chiefs still have done. And USA Today did some power rankings after free agency and where everybody was at. CBS Sports did their where the Chiefs rank in the AFC after the first and second wave of free agency. The one that stood out was from USA Today, just because they had the Chiefs now fifth. With their rankings, they were second, if you're wondering, before free agency began. So in their mind, here's what they said. Quote, they found a way to keep right guard Trey Smith, linebacker Nick Bolton, wide receiver Hollywood Brown and Kareem. They should get wide receiver Rashee Rice back. But some key players departed, namely all-pro guard Joe Tooney and the left side of an O-line that utterly collapsed in the Super Bowl loss currently seems as suspect as ever. That was their logic for why they slipped back to fifth. And I'll be honest, it's hard to really be all that upset about the Chiefs being fifth in the power rankings because it is still an unknown at their biggest weakness. Why I like the Jalen Moore signing. We've discussed that.
We don't know for sure. We also liked the Kingsley pick.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think they did as well as they could have knowing that Ronnie Stanley never hit the open market. Right. If you consider the other options and the money and the draft, what we think the draft is going to be, I think they did as well as they could. But I think it's fair. If you're telling me a team's starting left tackle is a question mark, I think it's more than fair to have that team fifth in your power rankings. And we can, if you're wondering, we can go through one through four. If you're just, you can probably guess the teams that are in front of them. But
the Eagles?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are one of them. That is correct, Cody. The Eagles would be one of the teams that are in front of the Chiefs when it comes to their power rankings. They were number one. The Bills were two. The Ravens were three. The Rams were four. Now, you might take issue about the Bills being higher. I
guess that's where I ask the question is, like, if I look at the Bills and the Ravens offseason, I actually think they caught up less or closed less of a gap against the Chiefs than some of the other teams. Like, I think the Chargers did a better job closing the gap, or the Broncos did a better job closing the gap than where they were. Look, maybe that doesn't put them
up
to
top five. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that doesn't make them the Bills or make them the Ravens, but they've done a better job closing the gap than either the Bills or the Ravens, in my opinion. And look, there is still a gap. They continue to beat these teams in the playoffs. They've beaten now in three consecutive years, the Bengals, the Bills, and the Ravens in the postseason. The three teams that have chased them the most over this last 4-year run. And so I guess I don't look at what the Bills did. I'm like, how's that any better than what the Chiefs did? Their offensive line is about the same, which was really good. Their defense is about the same, which was pretty good. And like, yeah, did they get a little bit better? Maybe a pass rush with Khalil Mack instead of Von Miller feels like mostly a wash for me.
I think
one aging pass rusher for another. Like, I don't see major moves other than now. I feel like the Ravens have an absolute steal with Derrick Henry based on the price tag of some other running backs. Like, they all feel like those three teams feel like they're on the same level.
So two things with it. One, some of this still is a carryover from last year where multiple national publications heading into the playoffs thought the Bills and the Ravens were better, right? So that some of this is a carryover.
Remember, somebody tried to say the Ravens were better even after they lost to the Bills and didn't even play the Chiefs.
We played the audio. Steve Fezzik. We played the audio. And he was like, hey, despite my metrics being wrong, I'm still digging my heels in further. And I'm, you know, basically is what he said. So some of it is that. I think a lot of people outside of Kansas City, and I think it's a fair criticism here, even in Kansas City, the Chiefs are banking on a lot of the same pieces on a team that went 15-2, by the way, but banking on a lot of the same pieces bouncing back, right?
Like if you say like Mac, Joey Bosa, but like him and Palmer, it's like,
Your free agency class, other than Jalen Moore, the Chiefs brought in the same guys. And we like the Christian Fulton signing as well. But you know what I'm saying? I think from the outside, they say, okay, you brought back Hollywood Brown and Nick Bolton and Trey Smith. Okay. And, you know, I think that's where people nationally are really looking. And if you are the Chiefs, they have clearly showed through their free agency actions. And I'm not saying it won't work. They have said, hey, we never had Worthy, Rice, and Brown on the field at the same time. We think that is going to be a huge boost right away, like adding a whole new offensive of receiver core room. You know, we haven't had that there. You know, you and I were critical. I wouldn't have brought back Kareem Hunt, but they chose to do that. As long as they still draft an explosive running back, I'm not going to hate it. You know, Pacheco will be healthy.
I do reserve the right to hate it if they do not draft a running back. Fine. I just want to make it clear. I reserve the right to hate it later.
But I think that's why it's easy. And I get it from the outside. Like, well, they didn't change anything with the team. They think they found maybe a solution to left tackle, but they didn't change anything. But I also get the logic on the Chiefs end, which is, that wide receiver room is like, if you can have post-suspension, if he gets suspended, Rice and Worthy and Brown on the field at the same time, that is a very impressive wide receiver room if you stack it up against other AFC counterparts.
Yeah, that's an improvement. That counts as an improvement. The idea that all three of those players would be on the field at the same time with an upgraded left guard. I mean, again, look at what the other moves they made were. Like right now, the two biggest moves for the Buffalo Bills are Josh Palmer, which they needed a little wide receiver depth, so that helps, and Joey Bosa. You and I both agree. Aging hurt pass rusher for aging hurt pass rusher doesn't feel like it moves the needle that much. Hell, one of the Ravens' biggest moves was signing DeAndre Hopkins. No offense. Didn't make a huge effect on the Chiefs' offensive ability. Did it help a little? Sure. A ton? No.
What do you think the Ravens are expecting Hopkins to be? Because if they just wanted to be their
500 yard receiver,
well then there's no problem with it. If they're expecting him to elevate and be like their two, then that's quite a bit. Cause they have Zay Flowers, of course. And then I think Bateman's back and I believe he's still there,
but Rashad Bateman.
So I guess in that scenario, Hopkins as your three. Okay.
Like the way I view it, and this must be like, if you're making this list and you have those two teams ahead, you just thought they were always ahead and that's the case.
Probably.
But like just on paper, if they went from horrendously bad left tackle play to mediocre left tackle play, massive upgrade. And if they go from a wide receiver unit last year that did not have for any stretch of time, no Rashee Rice at all and no Hollywood Brown at all, essentially the entire year. And instead, you get Xavier Worthy and those two on a football field at the same time. That's more improvement than any other team in the AFC has made.
Yeah, you're rolling the dice a little bit, but yes, 100%. I mean, that is clearly. I mean, we said it when the first wave
of free agency. They still were 15-2 and went to the Super Bowl. Yeah. So like, it weren't like they were bad.
We said it when the first wave of free agency was going on. The Chiefs clearly are going with the plan of we just think we never got to see what they thought. And if it fails again, and I say fails as in they struggle on offense, not the win total. They didn't fail last year. The only standard they're held to, of course, is Super Bowl nowadays. So I guess they failed by that mark. But they weren't a bad football team. They made the Super Bowl and won 15 games. But they are banking on the wide receiver room. The only reason why the offense stunk last year at times was because they didn't have the wide receivers they thought they had. And their left tackle gave them no chance. And they're saying, we think that we brought in a tackle that can give us adequate play. And we think that our wide receiver room was totally fine. We just didn't have them available. And they're banking on them being available. That's the dice roll they're taking heading into the 2025 season.
It's not crazy dice roll. Obviously, the biggest part of that problem right now is Rashee Rice potential suspension more than anything else probably at this point. Because typically a player is not going to get hurt 2 years in a row. He was not an injured player in college. Worthy was not an injured player in college. Hollywood Brown on the other end, he is injury prone. So, like, counting on him for a full 17-game slate feels like. But also, it always points out, like, it's easier to keep someone healthy if they're not the bell cow. He was the number one wide receiver there for a stretch in Baltimore. And, you know, like sometimes it's easier to keep a guy healthy if they're not having to like be the guy who plays all the time. And we'll just kind of see based on that end. But yeah, I still think, you know, like they want to put those two teams ahead. The only logic for me in doing that is if you had them ahead at the end of the season, which is always hard to quantify because they won more games, went further in the playoffs. And in my opinion, just based on like what we think will be the additions, have done more.
Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll get back to the NCAA tournament, Sweet 16. We got the field of 16. That'll start up on Thursday. We'll talk more about what we make of the teams that are left. We'll check in on our Cody and Gold Bracket Challenge, see how some of you are doing. We always read the top five listeners, and oh yeah, the bottom five listeners as well. We will get to that, plus find out how the three of us are doing in that in just a bit. But let's get back to the Royals. And in addition to maybe a move they have to make if we get some injury news or something today, they did make some roster moves. The only one that was slightly surprising was because of how they once talked about this player. But in fairness, he wasn't consistent enough. And that was Carlos Hernandez not making the roster and then ultimately getting claimed by the Philadelphia Phillies through waivers. Nick Prado, Nelson Velasquez did make it through. Nobody claimed them, so they're going to be in AAA barring some other change or something like that. But Carlos Hernandez was somebody that they spoke highly about for many years. He had the stuff, but just was never consistent enough.
And they had to risk it because of other arms.
And they chose like Chris Stratton, for example. They kept him on. And some of it, yeah, this is an option thing. No options left for Carlos Hernandez. That was part of the scenario. So the thought about Carlos Hernandez, and it'll be interesting to see if he does anything in Philadelphia. They also made a small trade. Well, though the trade now could end up being a little bit more of an impact based off of potentially the Vinny injury. But they bring in a veteran bat for cash considerations or a player to be named later. Mark Canha, 36-year-old veteran in a trade with the Brewers. Last year for Detroit and San Francisco, he was on two clubs, hit .242, seven homers, 42 RBI, and 95 hits on the season. Gives him a little bit of veteran experience. He can play outfield. He can play first base. So maybe that's where this comes into play.
Do you want to know what the most important stat for Mark Canha was? Last year for two different teams, his on-base percentage, .344, would have ranked second on the Kansas City Royals, or third, right around that range. And so, you want to know a stat more than anything else? He is a career .349 on base guy. They have obviously prioritized that the entire offseason. It is why they gave up a starter for Jonathan India. It is why it was so important that Bobby Witt Jr. was a big on base guy and why they think Vinny can continue to grow in that area. They brought in Canha for one reason and one alone: to play 70 games in random positions all over the field and get on base at a .350 clip. It's a perfectly fine signing because he plays everywhere. That's why you like it. He can even play a little first base if you need him to, depending on how long Vinny Pasquantino could be down for. And so
right,
this is one of those, like, I'm more worried about Canha. Just feels like that's a nice, safe vet move. Got no complaints. That's the kind of thing I think they were trying to accomplish in, like, the free agent signings. They were trying to get all off season and they weren't going to cave on like a bad price on them. So like Canha, 35, cool, fine. The Carlos Hernandez one has the biggest chance to burn him because I am also a believer in his arm talent. And when I look at the bullpen, you know what though? It's funny. It could burn him. But the reason why it makes me happy today is they're so deep that Carlos Hernandez, they couldn't make room for. This is a player who's been like the fourth guy called out of the third guy called out of the bullpen the last like 3 years in the big leagues, and they don't got room. They had to make a tough call on a good, talented pitcher because they don't got room in the bullpen because of how good it is, Gold. And maybe that's just a pie in the sky way to look at it, but you and I both know how much they value Carlos Hernandez, and they were unwilling to keep him on the opening day roster because he was out of options.
He was never consistent enough is part of the problem,
yeah,
too,
sure,
though.
Sure.
But, I mean, like, if you're just looking at the baseball card and the stats,
it's like a 5 ERA, probably.
Yeah, .495 ERA, pitched in 30 games, or 30 innings, not game, 30 innings last year, 27 games for them. But, yeah, I think you're right that this bullpen has been revamped, and everybody feels better about it heading into the season. We'll see if it lives up to that. It sure looks like it could be a big strength of this team after being a real problem for them up until Urseg arrived in the back half of the season. But yeah, it tells like that they're able to move on from somebody like that and still feel like they can be fine. I know there's some Royals fans that would have preferred a different move to go with it, but got to remember where some contracts are at for some guys and where options are at for some guys. And he didn't have an option remaining. So Carlos Hernandez is now a member of the Philadelphia Phillies. So Carlos Estevez is a Royal, and Carlos Hernandez is a Philly, and Estevez was on the Phillies before, so they swapped, you know?
I'll take the swap.
I don't think
it's a dead swap like that, because
I'm joking.
The Royals had to pay him money. Yeah. Versus
2 for 20, right? I think is what it was for.
Yeah, which was a lot for a reliever at the time, but I think that
he's
goes
a
back
closer.
To, that's why
opening
Canna
day.
Ended up. I just think they wanted one more guy in case they can't put Massey and India and him. Like it's just a safety net in case these guys aren't one of them or all three of them really Gold aren't everyday players. They just need one of those guys to be like an like in the Michael not India but Michael Massey MJ. They need one guy to be like, oh, he plays every day. That's it. And then, yeah, it's the on-base thing. 349, that's a good career on-base percentage. He had a 376 on-base percentage in the second half last year. So, I mean, you know, again, a kind of player who you can kind of count on, at least based on that. I want to look it up. Royals, stats, let's see. I was thinking it was second or third, probably. Where do you think 349, which is what his career
on-base? Oh, on the team
on
last
base,
year?
That's what his on-base percentage was last year, and it's around his
last
career
last year
average.
It would have been, at worst, fourth on the team. It may be better. At worst, fourth, I'll say.
Second.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought it might be third. Bobby Wood Jr. had a 389 on base percentage. Second place only played 18 games for them.
Oh,
so technically.
That didn't even count anyway. I don't qualify you 18
games. And he's still
games.
Below it at 338. He was Yuli Gurriel. Salvador Perez in a career resurgent year again. 330. Next highest, Freddie Freeman at 319. That's why they went for India. That's why Canna is appealing. They want someone. They know that they've got middle of the order bats. They know that they have Salvi and Bobby and Vinny, and those guys will put you in at home if you're just on base. But yeah, they didn't have anybody who was getting on base last year. Hell, they had more players with a sub 300 on base percentage in the starting lineup than guys who got on base at an over 300 clip. And so, you know, Canna, that one just is so inoffensive. It's always the same thing. It's like, I think people, this is how fandom works. Do you agree with this, Gold? Baseball fandom is they always hate the bench guy because he never looks like a starter. He doesn't look like Bobby Witt Jr. for the 80 games he plays, so they just always hate the bench guy. Even though that guy didn't do anything wrong, he's just out here trying to play 80 games, live his life.
They end up getting Canna. Remember, they were rumored to be in the mix for, I don't know if he ended up signing Adam Duvall. Remember that? Mm-hmm. That was somebody they decided, nah.
Duvall.
Yeah, they did not end up getting him. Instead, they get Canna.
I'm going to guess his career on base percentage is pretty good for the same reason. Quite bad, actually. I apologize. What the hell do they want Duvall for? I like Canna.
Well, nobody signed him, so.
Duvall. Guess they didn't want to give up a cash and a player to be named later. What's the best player to be named later ever? Do we know?
In Royals history? Or just like ever?
I don't know. Just ever, I guess. I was asking because I was just thinking about it now.
A quick Google search tells us Michael Brantley.
Oh my God. David Ortiz.
Jason Schmidt. Gio Gonzalez. Scott Pesednik. Coco Crisp. Those are some of the best.
Coco Crisp, they had that was an all name team. Coco Crisp,
Michael Brantley,
Milton Bradley,
and David Ortiz are the best, I think. I mean, Moises Alou too. I mean,
that was some pretty decent players to be named later in this world. I mean, even
think about how many there've been. And like, number one was David Ortiz because he ended up as a 46 WAR player. Coco Crisp by WAR was the second best ever player to be named later. Marco Scudero, you remember that name? He was third.
He's the third highest WAR player, Marco Scudero,
for player to be named later trades. Gio Gonzalez, Michael Brantley was fifth. Yeah, this is as of July of. Oh, this is an old article, so there could be some new members. This was as of 2015, so this is old.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so in the last 9 years, there might have been a better player to be named later than those, but yes.
I think Trey Turner was a player to be named later.
Was he? Okay.
Yeah, so that's a pretty good player. Mm-hmm. He'd probably be ahead of Scudero.
Yeah. we'll get into some Sweet 16 action here in about 8 minutes or so, but someone that's not part of the Sweet 16 is UConn. After back-to-back championships, much like the Chiefs, their three-peat campaign did not work out. Ultimately, they came up short. And Dan Hurley is so polarizing. We all know his style of coaching, emotional, to be nice. And I saw a lot of discussion around him and UConn when they were winning in their game against Florida for a bit. And then ultimately they lost. And it was like, hey, he's so good for college basketball. Oh, he's so good. And I think in sports, You got to have villains. However,
I don't like how we make villains.
It seem like being a giant a-hole is just like cool. Oh yeah, man. If you don't, you're just not cool if you don't like that stuff. No,
he's competitive, he cares more.
I think he's a jerk. You agree we need villains in sports, right?
Yes.
But
villains are important.
I don't like how we just, what's the right word? Like glorify. Yeah. Glorify being an a-hole. And that's what he is.
I guess my biggest problem. So like he is coming off of back-to-back national championships. He is undoubtedly one of the three best coaches in all of college basketball. And he does make a good villain because he wins a lot. And your team is always going to hate him because of how like brash and, you know, like kind of argumentative he is. But coming off the court as a two-time defending champion saying, well, I hope the refs like you better, Tech, is the most loser energy imaginable out of a head coach. You're a two-time national champion. You just won twice. You're complaining about the refs off the court in a round of 32 game? You're an eighth seed. You don't have to live like this. You can be angry and a jerk and be the guy who yells. You can be all those things. You got to have a little class somewhere at some point. That's the moment I would say, show a little class coming off the court. Don't be yelling into the stands. Hope the refs are better for you, Tech. Like, ugh.
Or Baylor, yeah.
Or like, Baylor,
they had Look, they had Florida's number there for a little bit, right? Like, that was close. I thought there was a fight. And then Walter Clay Jr., we were talking about the transfers. He was an Iona kid, and now he's one of the best players in the country. He had some, all year he's been doing this for Florida, but big shots for Florida down the stretch. They ended up winning comfortably at the end. But there was a bit there. I was like, is Dan Hurley going to take this because it's not a great UConn team. They were an eight seed, right? Eight seed for a reason. And I get it. Like I understand that I'm not acting like you don't want to see emotion from your coach. And there is probably truth that if you're a UConn fan, of course you love them. Duh. I understand. The guy's won you two national titles. I don't expect you to.
Oh yeah, I think they're fans. I'm sure.
But it's just one of those. And I think the Tech side is correct. And this is how sports work too. Like that emotion, that attitude. If you're not winning, it doesn't fly and you're done.
It's why every Bill Belichick coach has failed.
Because he's winning, he can get away with it. And that is the reality, no doubt. I'm just saying, like, just because if you don't like Dan Hurley, and I don't, it doesn't mean like, oh, you just don't get it. You know, he's great for the sport. No, he can be a villain, which is good for sports, and also think he's a giant prick.
I think that there's a line. And again, complaining at the refs or being like, they don't respect, whatever. That's who he is. That's his attitude. Complaining about the refs after losing in a round of 32 game, after you're a two-time defending national champion is, like, in a lot of ways, it's just unbecoming of an elite-level head coach. And it's not something I would want out of any workplace. And I guess sometimes it's like, I am less willing to forgive, like, well, it's just sports as part of an attitude. Because if you worked at any other place, if Spec, every time we got on the show, he'd been like, was just throwing a fit and throwing his stuff all over his office, I'd be like, dude, chill out. All right, just relax a little. Okay, you can be competitive. Like, I'm a competitive person, right? Drew and I like race or whatever. He's like, Cody's a little more, like, I can be a little competitive. I get it. We run into that stuff. It happens with people. I'm not even saying that. But, like, this, it's like a new level with Hurley. I mean, he feels like he has to take it to 100 every time. He doesn't have to. He can be good for the sport if he's just, like, at an 80 most of the time.
Yeah,
just find him.
I feel like this guy's gonna have a dang heart attack on the court. As he gets old. I mean, there's no. I mean, he is running at on a scale of 1 to 10. He's running at 15 every single time.
I think it's interesting because the way that he carries himself, you would think, you know, why would anybody want to play for him? But I think he really, really, really cares about his players a lot. And I think it shows. I think it shows in over emotion sometimes where. He's just a very emotional person, and he wears it on his sleeve to a fault at times, obviously, where he gets teed up, you know, more often than not. And you got Bill Raftery saying, you know, he's got to be careful over here already in the first half. Like, it's part of, I don't know if that's ever changing in Dan Hurley, and the fact that he's won.
No, this is who he is.
It's hard to really knock, not necessarily his coaching style, but I think it's hard to knock any reason of why it's not working or why it would be a hindrance.
Oh, I'm not saying it doesn't work. Clearly, it's worked, right?
Yeah.
They've won titles, and nobody's saying he can't coach. He obviously can coach. The separate conversation is more just the, like, you don't, you know,
It's easy to not like him. I think I can understand why a lot of people don't.
Yeah. Like, you know, everybody has their own style, but there's a point where, like, when we first saw it, like, I was like, wow, this is kind of crazy and almost like entertaining. And then now it's like, we're way past that point.
There's no
like,
way he would have worked out on the Lakers either, by the way. There's not a chance it would have worked.
Having a tantrum with officials in the NBA every five seconds.
He'd be screaming at LeBron to get back on defense the one time he doesn't, and LeBron would lose it.
All right, we're late for a break. Up next, I want to talk more about the 16 teams that are actually left in the tournament. Plus, we'll check in on our bracket challenge and a little update that Fesco gave this morning on the Royals Stadium future.